Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Frost clung to the blooming flowers and rising grasses spreading across the flat plains. The days were getting shorter, the long summer sunlight dwindling quickly as autumn approached with winter close on its heels. Here at the top of the world, just a few miles south of the Arctic Circle, the snow and the ice were never far away. But life went on, as it had for thousands of years. Winter would come, then spring behind it, then the fleeting summer once again. A herd of woolly mammoth trampled its way through the grass, munching on vegetation as it went, before stopping at a small, burbling stream. The gargantuan creatures drank and sprayed water through their trunks, trumpeting and socializing before moving on toward uneaten flowers and grasses. Bison followed in their wake, grazing in their dozens and hundreds. The big grazers kept a watchful eye out for the packs of gray wolves that stalked around the edges, looking for sick or injured animals on which to prey. The wolves weren't the only predators working their way across the plain. Clad in thick furs and hides, bundled up against the cold wind and clutching bone-pointed spears in their hands, a group of people squatted low in the tall grass near the stream. They were downwind of the bison, and the creatures were unaware of the hunter's presence. When the time was right, the people would leap from cover and hurl their spears at the bovines. One kill could be enough to feed their entire small band for days. So it had been for their entire lives, and those of their parents and grandparents on back into the mists of time. This land was their home. To the east lay Siberia, to the west, Alaska. In 10,000 or so years, the rising waters of the Pacific would swamp these plains, covering the broad grasslands of Beringia with the Bering Sea. Asia and the Americas would be separated once and for all. But for now, the megafauna grazed and wandered. The people followed them, hunting and living, generation after generation. Their descendants would spread to the east, following the herds into Alaska, then move south, more south, and still even further south, until they had spread everywhere from the Yukon to the southern tip of South America. Before long, these people would become the first Americans. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So, a quick note before we get into today's episode. Literally the day after I recorded this, a new paper was published in the journal Nature that presented really strong evidence of ancient occupation in Highland Mexico that goes back to at least 20,000 years ago, and probably even longer than that, maybe as far as 30,000 years before the present. I told y'all, this stuff moves pretty fast. Now, this particular development is not all that surprising. I leave the possibility of earlier settlement open throughout today's episode, but just know as you listen that this new piece of evidence exists and that any future story about the first Americans will have to work with this as the new starting point. It's wildly exciting. It's so cool to be right here as all this stuff is happening. Luckily for us, we have a great guest next week. Dr. Jennifer Raff, a specialist in this field, who can help us understand what these new discoveries mean. Until then, I hope you enjoy the episode, and please, please forgive me for being 24 hours behind the literal cutting edge of new scholarship. Aside from Antarctica, which still doesn't have a permanent human presence today, North and South America were the last continents to be populated. We've already seen how Homo sapiens and before us Neanderthals, Denisovans, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo erectus, and maybe even others all made their way out of Africa and then hung out in Eurasia for hundreds of thousands of years. But they never made their way to the Americas, to the vast expanse of land stretching from pole to pole. Maybe even as late as 16,000 years ago, there were no people south of present-day Alaska and the Yukon. Maybe not even there. Now, the Americas were a pretty inviting place. They were full of lush and fertile ground, stocked with giant, huntable game, everything from mammoth and mastodon to giant ground sloths. The Americas were no less hospitable than the tracts of Eurasia, where people had been living for millennia, or Australia, where humans first set foot at least 50,000 years ago. In fact, much of the Americas was considerably better suited to human habitation than, say, Europe at the last glacial maximum, about 20,000 years ago. And yet, people clung on in glacial refugia in Europe, and probably had yet to step foot south of Alaska. Why? Well, Eastern Siberia has a lot to do with it. This was a vast tract of supremely inhospitable land. Now, granted, there hasn't been a ton of archaeological work done there, in Siberia, you know, but there is no site securely dated to earlier than 35,000 years ago east of central Siberia. In fact, the earliest dated sites on the eastern fringe of what's now the Bering Strait are no older than about 14,000 years. There's nothing much, if any, older than that in Alaska. All of this is incredibly recent considering the timescales we've been working on with our first few episodes on the deep human past. But within 2,000 years of that, at the very most, people had not only entered the Americas but traversed their entirety. There were people living all the way to the south in Chile by no later than 12,000 years ago, probably before that. These first Americans, whoever they were, had colonized both continents practically overnight. So who were they? Where had they come from? When exactly did all this happen? How did they travel such vast distances so quickly? And what were their lives like? In today's episode, we'll meet these first Americans and try to understand their world. Everybody and every group has a past. The same is true of the first Americans. Long before they became the first Americans, they were members of other groups, other populations, with ties to still other groups who lived elsewhere in Eurasia. We can see this through their genes, which speak directly to their ancestry, and which help to fill in the incredibly sparse and spotty archaeological record from this long past time. To find this ancestry, we need to head back to Beringia, to the land we briefly explored at the beginning of today's episode. 23,000 or so years ago, the world was locked in one of the coldest periods of the last ice age. We talked about this in some detail last time, how the heavy glaciation meant enormous ice sheets covering much of the northern hemisphere, larger deserts, less rainfall, colder temperatures. With so much water frozen in those enormous, mile-thick ice sheets, sea levels were dramatically lower than they are today, as much as hundreds of feet lower at times. This meant that huge swaths of continental shelf were exposed above water, forming broad coastal plains that stretched well into what's now ocean. Sundaland in Southeast Asia connected Java, Sumatra, and Borneo to the mainland in a single landmass. New Guinea and Australia and other now islands were connected in similar fashion. And the North Sea between Britain and continental Europe was, when not covered in ice, an entire region called Doggerland. One of these exposed areas lay between what is now Siberia and Alaska, where the Bering Sea separates the westernmost tip of North America from the eastern extremity of Asia. This is commonly known as the Bering Land Bridge, but that dramatically understates the extent and size of this area. This was not some rickety causeway connecting two continents. Instead, Beringia, as it's more properly called, formed a single unified landmass stretching from the Kamchatka Peninsula to eastern Alaska, maybe 1,500 miles of mostly low-lying grassland. At its greatest extent, its center was more than 500 miles from the nearest open ocean. This was a vast area consisting mostly of mammoth steppe, the biome we talked about extensively in last week's episode. Cold, tough place to live, but shockingly productive, with thriving grasses and flowers that supported enormous herds of grazing animals like the eponymous mammoth. This large, extended region was almost certainly home for the ancestors of today's Native Americans. But where had they come from before this? Who had their ancestors been? Now, this is all really recent work, but let's try to go through it along with the specialists and turn it into some kind of coherent story. The genetic evidence is the best guide. Unsurprisingly, today's Native Americans share common ancestors with today's East Asians. Presumably, these ancestral populations were in relatively close proximity somewhere between what's now China and Siberia. But there are also some surprising things. Present-day Native Americans share a surprising amount of ancestry with today's Europeans, ancestry that predates the population movements of the last 500 years by millennia. Now, how could this be? Well, that shared ancestry comes from a group that contributed to both. As we talked about a couple of episodes ago, this is a ghost population, as geneticists call it, a group that once existed but which is no longer around today. The geneticists call these shared ancestors ancestral North Eurasians, a group that must have lived at least 25,000 years ago or even more. They were hypothesized on the basis of this genetic evidence, but we had no direct evidence of their existence. Pretty soon, though, direct evidence of these ancestral North Eurasians soon showed up. About 24,000 years ago, a young boy, perhaps 3 or 4 years old, was buried near Lake Baikal in Siberia. Malta boy, as he's known, wore an ivory diadem, a pendant in the shape of a bird, and a bead necklace. Researchers were able to extract DNA from his remains, and sure enough, Malta boy was a member of this ancient North Eurasian group. Malta boy's close relatives contributed about a quarter of the ancestry to the forerunners of Native Americans, presumably somewhere in central or eastern Siberia, prior to their migration to Beringia. Along with groups related to the ancestors of present-day East Asians, they produced the founding population that eventually, a long way down the road, gave rise to Native Americans. But these ancestors of Native Americans did not move on right away. They didn't go straight from Siberia to Alaska to Canada to the rest of the Americas. Based on genetic dates, roughly 23,000 years ago, they split off from the other populations that they'd been connected to. By no later than 18,000 years ago, probably earlier, these people had reached northeasternmost Asia and Beringia proper. But there was nowhere further to go, at least for the time being. Enormous ice sheets blocked off the rest of Alaska and Canada. There was no way to get across them overland. Well, what about by sea? No luck there either, at least for now. The ice sheets extended out into the ocean, these towering glacial cliffs covering the coastline, making any landing spots inaccessible for thousands of miles to the south. Now, even though these people were essentially stuck, there was nowhere for them to go further, Beringia was not a bad place to live, not by any stretch of the imagination. Our modern conception of Arctic tundra is just wrong. We should imagine something much more like the African savanna, albeit a much, much, much colder version, with huge herds of bison, mammoth, elk, and the like, instead of barren permafrost or deadly silent boreal forest. Here, these people stayed, living possibly as far east as the Yukon of Canada, for thousands of years more. The evidence is fragmentary, it's hard to date, and it's confusing. These early Beringians might have been there, crossing this now-lost landmass as early as 27,000 years ago, or perhaps as late as 16,000 years ago. It's entirely possible that there were even earlier waves, just small ones that died out amid the constantly changing climate of the last ice age, and we just haven't found good evidence in this sparsely populated land. So, Beringia it was. For the moment, there was nowhere else to go. But that would soon change.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits. Business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
We'll never know why the first Americans decided to go south from their Beringian home. Maybe they'd tried before and failed, stopped by the mile-thick ice and the glaciers projecting out into the ocean. Maybe some had actually succeeded, taking advantage of a momentary opening in the ice or a pathway along the coast to make their way south, and the signs of this were later wiped out by the relentless advance of the glaciers. All we can say for sure is that somewhere north of 15,000 years ago, maybe even a couple of thousand years earlier, a group of Beringian natives began their long, long journey south. But we know a few things about this band of migrants. First, they were a splinter population of those Beringians, not the entire group. A lot of the Beringians, presumably most of them, stayed behind, where they left descendants who remained for thousands of years more. Second, we know this group of initial migrants was fairly small, ranging in size from a couple of hundred to a few thousand people at most. The genes of indigenous people across the Americas, from Canada to Chile, point to a small founding population with limited genetic diversity that quickly grew. The genetic diversity of indigenous Americans today is almost entirely a subset of the genetic diversity of this founding group, with only limited new additions afterward. Third, these people moved fast. Really fast as they entered this uncharted landscape and multiplied in numbers with shocking speed. That's about all we can say for certain. We're not totally sure about their material lives and the specific kinds of tools they employed, though we can make some informed guesses. The precise date at which they went south is lost to us. So is the exact route. Scholars have spent the better part of a century or more arguing about when and how these first Americans got through the glaciers. The ice stuck around in great continent-spanning sheets long after the first unambiguously human remains and artifacts start showing up in the Americas. Who, when, and how? These are the big questions, and they're still under discussion today. If you're looking for some additional reading on these matters, you might check out David Meltzer's excellent book, First Peoples in a New World, Colonizing Ice Age America. It's quite up-to-date and comprehensive, and it's a great starting point. So, for a long time, most of the 20th century and even into the 21st, the consensus was that when was about 13 to 14,000 years ago. The Hu were a people who belonged to what's known as the Clovis culture, with a distinctive set of material artifacts and a way of life based on hunting megafauna like mammoth, bison, and mastodon. And how was through a narrow corridor that opened up between the two major ice sheets covering North America, the Cordilleran in the west and the Laurentide in the east, which were fused into one gigantic ice sheet, much bigger than Antarctica today, during the coldest periods of the Ice Age. This argument, known as Clovis First, was neat and attractive. It ticked all the boxes, so to speak. The hunters came south following the game they had already been accustomed to preying on in Beringia, tentatively venturing south through a recently opened hole in the ice. Once they reached the Americas, they followed these giant walking sources of meat across two new continents, hunting many of them to extinction, but in the process completely populating this new and promising land. Clovis First still has some adherents today, though vanishingly few of them. The reason it has so few supporters left is because it is demonstrably not correct. There were definitely Clovis people. They were actually quite important in populating the Americas. They were directly related to present-day indigenous Americans, and we'll talk a whole bunch about them shortly. But others had come before them. Probably not a lot longer before, mind you, but before, at least 1,000 years before. How did these earlier people get past the ice? They certainly didn't cross it on foot. Walking a couple of thousand miles across an ice sheet, pitted with crevasses and other dangers and utterly devoid of food and water, is absolutely not feasible. Maybe our dating of the ice-free corridor's opening is off by hundreds or thousands of years. Certainly possible. New studies have consistently redated it with more precision over the past few decades. But the simplest explanation is that these earliest Americans came down the Pacific coastline, either walking or paddling small boats or canoes. If there were places where the ice projected out into the ocean, these were not impassable with the watercraft technology that was presumably available at that time. After all, people must have crossed at least 60 miles of open water to reach New Guinea and Australia some 50,000 years ago. Skipping around a glacier while dodging ice floes amid stormy North Pacific seas would have been a serious challenge, but by no means an insurmountable one. So, using this coastal route, the early voyagers could have skipped from landing spot to landing spot, relying on the same kinds of marine resources like fish, shellfish, seal, and seaweed and kelp for sustenance without ever having to change their subsistence strategy. When they reached the mouth of a major river, like the Fraser River in British Columbia or the Columbia River between Washington and Oregon, they could have easily used it as a highway to reach the vast interior of the continent. And they could have kept going, further and further, some groups heading inland while others continued south. By no later than 14,500 years before present, perhaps even a couple thousand years earlier than that, one of these groups had reached as far south as central Chile. The site of Monte Verde sits on a terrace above a lagoon, about 30 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean up the Moyin River on a tributary creek. thanks to a spectacular geological quirk, this creek backed up and covered the site in water, creating a deposit of peat that preserved a stunning variety of ancient deposits. Not only stone tools and leftover animal bone, but even wooden objects, animal hide, traces of plant, and much more, the kind of thing that normally decays within years or decades rather than surviving through millennia. It is an extraordinary archaeological site, an incomparable treasure, even before taking its date into account. After years and years of brutal examination and constant questioning, Monteverde's status as a pre-Clovis site has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. If people were that far south at least a millennium before the first Clovis artifacts appear in North America, then they must have been living in the Americas for even longer. Monteverde is just the most famous and best-documented pre-Clovis site. Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania might have artifacts that are 16,000 years old. A site on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State produced a mastodon bone with an embedded bone projectile point of a pre-Clovis type that was just a bit younger than Monteverde, definitely pre-Clovis. Paisley Caves in southern Oregon are roughly as old as Monteverde. Researchers there have used a variety of cutting-edge and clever techniques to establish well-grounded dates. My favorite of these methods for establishing a human presence at a particular time, which are all incredibly clever, involve pulling human DNA from coprolites, that's a fancy way of saying poop, found in the caves. Along with the coprolites and animal bones, archaeologists found distinctive stone projectile points of a type known as the Western Stemmed Tradition. These are very different from the distinctive Clovis points, which we'll discuss shortly. Cooper's Ferry in Idaho has likewise produced western-stemmed type points. That site might even be older than Monteverde, perhaps 15,000 or even 16,000 years old. Other western-stemmed artifacts have shown up all across the western U.S., even as far east as Texas, and they might presumably be pre-Clovis in date as well. The precise dates, 14,000 years, 16,000 years, even more, are less important than the fact that they're old, they're pre-Clovis, and they're no longer in real dispute. But we have to be clear. We cannot say for certain that these early migrants, assuming they existed, took the coastal route. It is entirely logical to believe that they did so. These early migrants could get to Cooper's Ferry in Idaho, for example, by turning inland at the Columbia River, following the Columbia to the Snake, and then going from the Snake to the Salmon River. It's about 300 miles, not too much at all if you're a seasoned canoer or kayaker. The people who left those western stemmed points there might have come from the coast themselves or been first-generation inland migrants. Unfortunately, we lack direct, straightforward, and provable evidence for the coastal route. How can that be? How can we not know precisely how these people came south past the ice? Well, there are a few reasons. First and foremost, we have to grasp that there were very, very few people in these groups, or even a group, singular, of initial southward migrants. If they were hopping along the coastline, living in temporary encampments, what would they have actually left behind? Their shelters would have been made of organic materials. They presumably weren't staying in one place long enough to build up huge deposits called middens of shellfish, assuming that's what they ate. And they weren't intentionally discarding their tools, assuming they didn't rely on wood, antler, and bone, which don't preserve as well as stone in the first place. On top of that, this whole stretch of coastline from Alaska on down to Northern California is not exactly overflowing with people even today. It's not an environment that's conducive to preservation anyway. There's lots of rain, there's lots of river activity to wash away sites next to fresh water, not to mention heavy and persistent winter storms all along the shoreline. And if all of that weren't enough, don't forget that the sea level was dramatically lower then, perhaps as much as 400 feet lower. The coves where they may have landed their boats, the beaches where they may have collected shellfish, the coastal salmon runs where they may have taken in huge numbers of fish, their campsites, all of that. These ancient wanderers' coastline is now buried under hundreds of feet of Pacific Ocean. Now, there are ways around this. Researchers are doing all sorts of clever things, like the scholars analyzing coprolites from Paisley Caves for human DNA. Others are actually looking at what's now the seafloor for potential archaeological sites from this distant period. It's been done for Doggerland, for example, in what's now the North Sea. Who knows what the combination of ingenuity and luck might come across off the coast of British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. I wanted to dwell on this for a moment because we always, always have to bear in mind how provisional our knowledge is, what gaps there are, and how we have to make leaps of logic and faith, however justified, in order to make sense of the evidence at our disposal. And for now, that evidence points in the direction of a coastal migration predating the ice-free corridor through what's now Canada. We can surmise that these people came south along the coast, that their route has now mostly been lost to us, and that there almost certainly weren't very many of them. They moved fast, they lived lightly on the landscape, they covered thousands of miles of ground very quickly. The numerous extremely ancient remains found in the submerged caves of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico are presumably representatives of this wave of expansion, along with the people who left coprolites at Paisley Caves and the folks who made it all the way to Monteverde. As far as we know, at this particular moment in our study of the topic, they were the first Americans.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
So these people may have been the first Americans, but others soon followed. I mentioned the Clovis First theory a while back. The idea that down that fortuitous ice-free corridor came a group of big game hunters with a distinctive technological toolkit, and that this was the founding group that then spread out all over the Americas. We now know that there were others before them, but the Clovis people really did exist. They probably did come down that ice-free corridor. They really did expand rapidly and drastically across the continent, and they really did leave a great deal of ancestry to all subsequent indigenous peoples of the Americas. They're important, and they matter. Back in the 1920s and early 1930s, people digging near the town of Clovis, New Mexico, way up on the Llano Estacado, the high plains that span West Texas and eastern New Mexico, found a whole bunch of distinctive stone spearheads. These spearheads were found around and embedded in the bones of extinct animals, mostly mammoth and ancient bison, so they had to be old, had to be really old. The town of Clovis gave its name to these distinctive points. Once they knew what they were looking for, researchers started to find them everywhere. Sites associated with the Clovis culture burst into the archaeological record quite suddenly between about 13,200 and 12,900 years ago, and then show up with shocking speed all across North America and even beyond. We can tell for one simple reason: a distinctive stone tool technology embodied in a very distinctive projectile point, the kind of thing you'd put on the end of a stabbing or throwing spear. These are called Clovis points, and once you see one, you know them on sight. That's because, first of all, they're quite beautiful, as stone tools go, a really aesthetically pleasing design. The edges are very carefully and methodically pressure flaked, using an antler or bone to chip off minuscule pieces of stone to create an even cutting edge that flows back to either parallel or curves back in toward the center. Both sides of the spearhead are also fluted, meaning that they have grooves notched into each of the two faces that run upward from the bottom, where it would be hafted onto a shaft toward the point. I put pictures of these on the Substack post that goes along with this episode, if you'd like to see them. You can also do a quick Google search, if you'd like, before you move on with this episode. They're a really gorgeous piece of Stone Age technology. So, Clovis points have been found all over North America, everywhere from the Pacific Northwest to the Great Plains to the Eastern Seaboard, then back up north into Canada where that ice-free corridor opened up between the two ice sheets. Heading south, these distinctive Clovis points have shown up in Mexico, Central America, even the northern reaches of South America, all within a pretty restricted time span. These folks moved fast, and the distribution of Clovis points speaks to that. In fact, a lot of the finds of Clovis points have come in caches, with large numbers of these beautiful objects stored away for future use at some point in the group's territory, then left or forgotten for good. The standard interpretation of the Clovis people is that they were big game hunters. Clovis points were well suited to that task. They probably would have been carefully placed into a split shaft and then secured in place with a mixture of pine resin and cording. They could have been used in darts, spears, or even as knives. They can be as much as 4 inches long. But their best use would have come as throwing spears, particularly when combined with what's called a spear thrower, or an atlatl. Basically, this is a length of antler, wood, or bone that's either held in the hand or attached to the thrower's forearm with a leather thong. The spear or dart then goes at the end of the spear thrower, secured in place with a hook or something like that. Basically, an atlatl gives the thrower a longer lever, which means more force and velocity behind the spear, and therefore damage to the target. They're common across cultures. They show up everywhere from Australia to America to ancient Greece and Rome to Aztec Mesoamerica, where we get the term atlatl. If you've ever used one of those plastic things to throw a tennis ball for a dog, you get the exact idea here. Awesome for entertaining a dog at a park, even better for hurling a razor-sharp piece of finely crafted stone 90 miles an hour at a big prey animal. With Clovis points and spear throwers, these early Americans could take down even the biggest game. Mammoth, mastodon, bison, pretty much anything that was available in the new landscape they were exploring. Butchered big game bones from a huge variety of species have been found at archaeological sites associated with the Clovis culture, and the standard interpretation is that they were skilled, adaptable hunters with a yen for meat. The fact that many of these enormous creatures, the megafauna, soon went extinct may well have had something to do with the success of the Clovis people and their distinctive weapons, though a dramatically changing climate was likewise a factor. Points are the best known and most distinctive Clovis artifacts, but they were just one piece of a really widespread toolkit. Large, double-sided stones used as cores from which blades could be made or flake struck, end scrapers, and a variety of knives, flake cutting tools, notched pieces, and so on, along with bone and ivory rods that survive less frequently. They certainly used perishable artifacts like animal hide, fur, baskets, mats, bags, and probably nets, but these basically never survive. Like the points, Clovis tools tend to be pretty similar wherever they're found, though particular tool types are more common in some places than others. One author, David Meltzer, refers to the Clovis toolkit as possessed of a certain quote-unquote monotony. Compared to other tool-making traditions, there really isn't a ton of variation in style or type. The tools aren't decorated. There's essentially no art that can be dated to this period. There's absolutely nothing that compares to the Paleolithic cave art of Europe that we talked about last time. But, as I mentioned before, the tools themselves, especially the points, are quite beautiful, they're wonderfully functional, and they tend to be extraordinarily well-made from the best quality stone that would have been available. In that sense, they speak to the minds and attitudes of the people who created them. If it's not being too imaginative, taking too great a leap from the evidence, we might think of the Clovis people as utilitarian master craftspeople. They knew what they were doing. They worked from a standardized toolkit, presumably one that had developed among that initial founding group, and which spread as their descendants multiplied and colonized North America and beyond. Since there were no or very few other people to meet throughout most of this vast expanse of land, the toolkit didn't really change very much, except by gradual drift over time, or in response to dramatically differing environmental conditions and needs. We can guess that these people ranged widely. If they were like more recent hunter-gatherers, each band of somewhere between 25 and 100 people covered as much as 7,000 square miles in crisscrossing seasonal patterns. Each generation, these groups would have ranged a bit further, a couple of dozen or even 100 more miles, with hunting parties scouting out new pathways along river valleys and following the routes of migrating herds. It would have been hard to move too far into a brand new landscape, though. Even if they were hunters by nature and trade, they still would have relied on gathering dozens of different types of wild plants for the bulk of their dietary needs. Even hunting isn't a single skill set. Going after a single mammoth on an open plain is nothing like stalking a mastodon in a forest or trying to take a whole herd of bison in rolling hills. Knowing what you could eat and where it could reliably be found was a matter of genuine life and death, and that meant sticking to at least relatively familiar landscapes. You would only venture a bit further at a time rather than taking enormous, daring leaps with entire groups in a single bound. That's not to say it didn't happen, but remember, you would need a critical mass of people in order to establish a viable community that could leave descendants in the future. One of the fascinating things about the Clovis people is that we actually know very little about the people themselves. You might be wondering, after spending so much time talking about human remains and ancient DNA, why we've yet to give them any real attention here. That's because there is literally nothing to work with, at least until the point we're reaching now. Actually, that's not quite true. The earliest ancient DNA evidence in the Americas comes from those wonderful coprolites, those pieces of ancient poop found in Paisley Caves in southern Oregon. This confirms that the pre-Clovis people belonged to the same maternal and paternal lineages whose descendants we still see among indigenous Americans today. But we've yet to find any actual pre-Clovis human remains. And to date, only one single set of human remains has ever been found in association with a site of the Clovis period. Back in 1968, some workers doing construction on a privately owned ranch in Montana discovered the remains of an infant in a collapsed rock shelter. Like a cave, but more of an overhang instead of a whole complex. The little guy was maybe a year or two old. His bones were covered in red ochre, a distinctive pigment, probably as some kind of burial ritual. And he'd been buried with a wide array of tools that all had the distinctive Clovis shape. Radiocarbon dating showed that he had died somewhere around 12,700 years before the present. Researchers later carried out DNA analysis on the infant's remains, the only direct genetic evidence we have of the people who made these incredible and widely distributed Clovis artifacts. Anzac I, as this little guy is known, was definitively a member of the ancient population that produced pretty much all indigenous Americans. His ancestors hadn't come from Europe or Polynesia or Japan or what have you. The Clovis people were, in fact, the forerunners of today's indigenous Americans. But, as we know at this point, it's not quite that simple. It never is. Anzac I, and presumably the Clovis people more generally, were actually more closely related to the present-day indigenous Americans of Mesoamerica and South America than he was to those of North America. These people represent one branch, a somewhat counterintuitive one, of the expansion out of Beringia. And when we compare Anzac I's genes to those of other ancient individuals, we can see that there were already deep splits in the populations that existed this far in the past. The Tanana Valley of central Alaska lies on the American or eastern side of Beringia, that vast and now lost region we talked about earlier in today's episode. The Athabascan-speaking indigenous people who live there today call it Upward Sun River. Upward Sun River would have been at the far eastern edge of that Beringian zone 11,500 years ago, when the people who lived there buried three children in what had been the central hearth of a residence, presumably where they lived. One of the three children was 3 years old. The other two were neonates, one who died 6 to 12 weeks after birth. The other was a late-term fetus. The two neonates were buried beneath the hearth, and 40 centimeters above them, the three-year-old was cremated and their remains interred. These are the oldest remains ever discovered on the American side of Beringia, and the neonates were preserved well enough for DNA to be extracted. When analyzed, researchers found that they belonged to a distinct population that had already split off from those that led to Anzac I. The people who buried those children at Upward Sun River almost 12,000 years ago weren't alone in the far north. They were closely related to a small child who was buried at Trail Creek Caves on what's now the Seward Peninsula of western Alaska some 9,000 years ago. These people presumably belonged to one group descended from the ancient Beringians we talked about earlier, those people who had occupied the whole vast stretch from Kamchatka to central Alaska prior to the ice sheets receding far enough for folks to head south to the Americas. The Beringians didn't stop existing when some of their number decided to test their luck south of the ice. Instead, those who stayed behind left descendants, some of whom lived at Upward Sun River and Trail Creek Caves. These people represent one lineage, but it's not one that still exists today. People living in what was once Beringia now have different ancestry, which we'll talk about shortly. So, we have Anzac I, who represents one branch of this ancient Beringian population that expanded southward and which eventually led to the indigenous peoples of Mesoamerica and South America. Then we have the descendants of the ancient Beringians themselves, as represented by the children at Upward Sun River and the Seward Peninsula. But what about the people living in North America today? Who were their ancestors? How were they related to these other groups? There was another group, a third group, that stayed further to the north. These people split off from those who went further to the south a couple thousand years before Anzac I was buried in Montana, and their descendants stuck around in what's now the Pacific Northwest for a very long time. The 9,000-year-old Kennewick man, the ancient one I discussed with Danish geneticist Eske Willerslev in an interview a few weeks back, had most of his ancestry from this group, this northern group. So do a lot of the indigenous people living in North America today. So we can see this three-part model very clearly. The ancient Beringians, some of whom then branched into first the Clovis people slash Meso and South Americans, and then the northern group. The evidence is really clear. Small initial populations of migrants, which diverged from the source group at a specific time and which then spread and multiplied very quickly across the Americas. These new groups, descended from the initial migrants, often then lived in isolation from one another for very long periods of time, thousands of years. This is how we explain the extreme linguistic diversity of the Americas, for example. But it still gets more complicated than that. There are whispers of other groups, other processes, other movements of people that we can't see as clearly, at least not yet. The first of these whispers shows up in South America. 10,000-year-old remains from Lagoa Santa in Brazil, along with the genes of some present-day indigenous peoples in the Amazon, show a tiny little bit of ancestry from a population related to today's Australasians, Papuans and Melanesians, for example. Now, that doesn't mean that people from Melanesia paddled all the way across the Pacific and lived in South America before these first Americans showed up. It does mean that a group with some ancestry related to these Australasian people, who probably lived somewhere in mainland Northeast Asia, contributed just a little bit of ancestry to people who eventually came to live in what's now Brazil. This must have happened deep in the ancient past, if 10,000-year-old remains from Brazil already show this ancestry. I don't know exactly how to explain this. Neither do the researchers who detected this faint and mysterious signal hiding in the genes. We hear the second whisper north of Brazil, among people living in what's now Mesoamerica. At some point in this period, a group that had long before diverged from that common ancient Beringian population, maybe as much as 30,000 years before the ancient Beringians became separated from their other groups living in East Asia, this group that had separated interbred with the ancestors of today's Mesoamericans. We have not the foggiest idea who these people were, where they lived, where they'd come from, or what their lives were like. They are a true ghost population, one that we know must have existed from their genetic traces, but that we know absolutely nothing about. In that sense, they're like the archaic humans of Africa we discussed a few weeks back, or the ancient North Eurasians prior to researchers sequencing the genome of Maltaboy, whom we talked about earlier today. What these two whispers tell us is that we can model the basic dynamics of how people came to live in the Americas pretty simply. Early migration, probably coastal, that left traces at Paisley Caves in Oregon and Monteverde in Chile. Then Clovis people who rapidly spread to Central and South America. Then later movements of people, presumably from the Pacific Northwest. But that general picture disguises the fact that there must have been other groups as well, small ones. Maybe they'd left earlier than the Clovis people, or the pre-Clovis migrants who left their poop at Paisley Caves. Maybe they'd been isolated in the Americas for thousands of years, living in such small numbers that they left no recognizable trace, carrying their distinctive Australasian and other ancestry. Maybe they were contemporary with those coastal and Clovis migrants, but they came from a genetically distinct founding population with that bit of Australasian ancestry. Maybe they'd been isolated in a particular part of Beringia or broader East Asia for a long time prior. Or maybe they came down from the north a bit later, but still deep in the buried ancient past to leave these whispers behind for us to hear millennia later. At least for now, we don't know. One thing we do know is that while these early migrations account for the vast majority of indigenous American ancestry and essentially all of it below the southern United States, these were not the last migrants to enter the Americas. How do we know that? Well, remember the Upward Sun River people, one of the branches descended from the ancient Beringians? Well, they're not around anymore. Other people now live in the Tanana Valley, people who speak an Athabascan language. They're genetically distinct from the Upward Sun River people. They must have come later. Now, Athabascan is interesting. It's a language family that's really broadly distributed across North America. Many of the languages of Alaska and northwestern Canada are Athabascan. So are some of the languages of the American Southwest, like Navajo and Apache. The Athabascan languages belong to a larger family of languages called Na-Dene, in the same way that English and Latin are both Indo-European languages. But, and this is where it gets really interesting, Na-Dene, that language family, seems to be related to a family of languages currently spoken in central Siberia, a family called Yenisian. If this is correct, then the speakers of the parent language must have come from Siberia to North America, or vice versa, at some point after the initial wave of migrations that we've talked about today. The genetic evidence backs this up. Athabascan speakers mostly resemble the northern group of that three-part branch of initial migrants. We know this by comparing them with the ancient DNA samples, like that of Kennewick Man. But Athabascan speakers today also have a small segment of later ancestry, about 10%, that they share with Siberian groups. How do we explain this? Well, today's Inuit, the people who inhabit the northern fringe of North America, are actually relatively recent arrivals. They're new migrants who came along the Arctic Circle from Alaska in the last 1,000 years or so. They came into this harsh northern land after a group known as the Dorset people, whose ancestors, the pre-Dorset, had arrived in North America in a migration from Siberia about 6,000 years ago. These pre-Dorset people were almost certainly the folks responsible for that 10% of ancestry that Athabascan speakers today share with Siberians. As they melded with groups already present in the Americas, they retained their distinctive language, that little bit of distinctive ancestry, and then spread out everywhere from Arizona to northern Alaska. Long after Beringia submerged beneath the waves, that highway from Siberia to the Americas remained open. This wasn't a one-way street either. The Chukchi of far eastern Siberia today derive about 40% of their ancestry from back migration from the Americas. And brand new research, literally just a few weeks old, has shown that some of today's Polynesians, particularly those living on Easter Island, Rapa Nui, have a bit of ancestry from indigenous Americans from Colombia. The most likely explanation is that seafaring Polynesians came to what's now Colombia, took some indigenous Americans back home with them, interbred, and then their descendants later went on to colonize Easter Island. That is a complicated story, even before we start talking about more recent population movements within the Americas, of which there have been many. We'll come back to those in a later episode. The fact that it's so complicated and that we have to draw on so many different sources of evidence, genes, stone tools, environmental science, and so on, just to make sense of it, should tell us a lot about how complex the deep human past really is. We're talking about enormous spans of time, vast distances, and real people who moved, lived, and died. These were the first Americans, and they are still with us today. Next time on Tides of History, we've got a great interview with a guest who can hopefully shed some more light on some of this incredibly complicated stuff. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Raff, and she's an expert on the ancient genetics of the Americas. So I'll get to pick her brain and hopefully make some of this DNA stuff clearer. After that, when we come back to scripted episodes, we'll begin our long journey from hunting and gathering toward the first signs of something new, agriculture, which would change the face of the planet and human society forever. Until then, thanks so much for joining me today. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about, go to patrickwyman.substack.com, patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and video in a post to go along with some thoughts on each episode. I also write essays on current events and historical perspective, but feel free to skip those if you just want the prehistory. Again, that's patrickwyman.substack.com. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show on both of those platforms at Tides History. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.